Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Did you know you can get Democracy Now!'s daily news hour, including our headlines, stories, and even special web exclusives, delivered directly to your inbox every day? Just text Democracy Now!, all one word, to 66866 to subscribe today. And make sure you never miss a single story. Once again, just text Democracy Now!, all one word, to 66866. That way we can stay in touch. And thank you so much. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
These are your victories, Salman. You and Mohammed Salman, these are your great achievements. Slaughtering children and women, these are your traits, you criminal.
Yemenis condemn the rulers of Saudi Arabia after a Saudi-led airstrike hits a wedding party in northern Yemen, killing 20 people. We'll get the latest. Plus, we go to Memphis, where a prominent Latino journalist, Manuel Duran Ortega, faces deportation after he was arrested while reporting 3 weeks ago at a protest against immigration policies.
Buenas tardes, amigos de Memphis Noticias. En estos momentos iniciamos la participación a todos ustedes.
This protest is going to be held in front of 201 Poplar. And let me tell you what is the purpose of this demonstration. As you can see, everything is getting ready here.
And we look at the future of Cuba as a new leader succeeds Raul Castro. Plus, we look at how an ABC journalist's secret liaison with Fidel Castro changed the course of the Cold War. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Yemen, a U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition airstrike tore through a wedding party late Sunday, killing at least 20 people. Most of the dead were reportedly women and children who were gathered in one of the wedding party tents. The bride was also among those killed. Medics and residents said more than 30 others were injured in the attack in the Bani Qais district in northern Yemen. At the scene of the bombing, one man lashed out at Saudi Arabia.
They always target weddings. They kill children and innocent people. But we can only complain to God, not to any human rights or any country in the world.
More than 15,000 people have been killed since the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition intervened in Yemen in March 2015, backed with U.S. intelligence, weapons and munitions. Saudi-led airstrikes have devastated Yemen's health, water and sanitation systems, sparking a massive cholera outbreak. It's believed a million people have cholera in Yemen and pushing millions of Yemenis to the brink of starvation. We'll have more on the latest attack and the crisis in Yemen after headlines. In Toronto, Canada, a man driving a white van barreled at high speed through busy downtown streets Monday, swerving onto sidewalks and seeming to aim at pedestrians, leaving 10 people dead and 15 others injured. Police say the driver, 25-year-old Alec Manassian, was apprehended without a shot fired after he told officers he was carrying a gun, then shouted, "Shoot me in the head." The officer would not shoot him. Manassian left behind a path of injury and destruction nearly a mile long. Canada's federal public safety minister said investigators were still searching for a motive, but did not believe there was a national security motive behind the attack. In Tennessee, police have arrested the gunman believed to be responsible for Sunday morning's mass shooting at a Nashville area Waffle House, which left 4 people dead and 4 others wounded. 29-year-old Travis Ranking was apprehended early Monday afternoon, not far from his apartment complex. He was carrying a backpack containing a pistol and ammunition and was arraigned on 4 counts of murder. Last year, Ranking had his firearms license revoked by Illinois police at the FBI's request after a string of erratic behaviors, including trespassing at the White House. The guns were then turned over to his father, who allegedly returned them to his son, including the AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle used in Sunday's attack. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted unexpectedly Monday to recommend Mike Pompeo to be confirmed as Secretary of State. The surprise outcome came as Kentucky Republican committee member Rand Paul unexpectedly voted in favor of Pompeo after repeatedly criticizing him over support for torture and for the invasion of Iraq. Pompeo's nomination had been widely expected to advance to the full Senate without a favorable recommendation from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which would have been the first time in a century that that had happened. But his bid was aided after at least three Democrats, Senators Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, and Joe Donnelly, said they'll vote to confirm Pompeo from the floor. Pompeo also has a long history of ties to Islamophobic organizations, and the National Iranian American Council has warned Pompeo's confirmation would threaten the Iran nuclear deal and increase the risk of a U.S. attack on Iran. Meanwhile, more than 100 former top U.S. military officials have signed a letter to senators asking them to oppose President Trump's nomination of the Central Intelligence Agency's deputy director to replace Mike Pompeo as CIA chief. The letter reads in part, "We are deeply troubled by the prospect of someone who appears to have been intimately involved in torture being elevated to one of the most important positions of leadership in the intelligence community," unquote. According to the New York Times, Gina Haspel oversaw waterboarding of prisoner Abdulrahim al-Nashiri at a secret CIA black site in Thailand in 2002. She also later advocated for destroying videotapes of another prisoner's waterboarding. Members of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee are in talks to delay Wednesday's planned confirmation hearings for Dr. Ronny Jackson to become Veterans Affairs Secretary amidst reports of unspecified allegations of improper conduct during parts of his career. Jackson's currently serving as President Trump's personal White House physician. He has no leadership experience heading a vast government bureaucracy like the VA, the second largest agency in the U.S. government. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron and French First Lady Brigitte Macron to a formal state visit Monday, kicking off 3 days of events with a trip to George Washington's former Virginia plantation home of Mount Vernon. Today, Macron is expected to press Trump in face-to-face talks to keep the U.S. in the Iran nuclear deal. Tomorrow, President Macron will address a joint session of Congress. The state visit comes after France's lower house of parliament advanced an immigration bill introduced by Macron that would toughen France's immigration and asylum laws. The bill would shorten deadlines for migrants to apply for asylum, while doubling the time that authorities can detain them to 90 days. It would also allow for a one-year prison term and fines for migrants found to have illegally crossed into France. Children could also be jailed with their families. The bill also continues a policy under which French citizens face fines and prison sentences for helping undocumented migrants, so-called crimes of solidarity. This is French parliamentarian Mathieu Orphelin.
I think it's unbelievable that in 2018, a citizen who acts in solidarity with a migrant or asylum seeker to help them during a health emergency, for example, can be convicted of that today in France. I think it's completely anachronistic, and this crime of solidarity must be profoundly modified.
In Greece, a mob of far-right militants attacked a crowd of asylum seekers Sunday night who gathered for a peaceful demonstration on the island of Lesbos, throwing stones, bottles and flares and sending at least a dozen migrants to the hospital. The violence erupted after some 200 migrants gathered for a sit-in protest to call for improvements to the squalid conditions in their refugee camps. They were attacked by members of the Mytilene Patriotic Movement, who chanted, "Burn them alive and throw them in the sea." After anti-fascist activists intervened, fighting broke out for several hours before riot police used tear gas to clear the crowds. At least 100 people were arrested. Lesbos has been the arrival point for thousands of migrants who've made the perilous voyage across the Mediterranean from North Africa seeking asylum. It's currently home to about 10,000 asylum seekers. The White House sought Monday to defend a presidential tweet that's being blasted by immigrant rights groups as openly racist. The April 18th tweet was one of many recent attacks by President Trump on sanctuary cities that seek to protect undocumented immigrants. It read, quote, "There is a revolution going on in California. So many sanctuary areas want out of this ridiculous crime-infested and breeding concept," unquote. the president tweeted. This is White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders being questioned Monday by reporters Jim Acosta and April Ryan.
When he used the word breeding, was he making a derogatory term about Latinos in California, that they breed a lot or that they're prone to breeding?
No, he's talking about the problem itself growing and getting bigger.
What does breeding mean to this president? Because when you think of breeding, you think of animals breeding.
I'm not going to begin to think what you think. Certainly, I think that it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. But the president is talking about a growing problem, and I addressed that with Jim. I don't have anything else to add.
In Tucson, Arizona, a federal jury has acquitted Border Patrol agent Lonnie Swartz on murder charges nearly 6 years after he shot and killed a 16-year-old Mexican teenager, Jose Antonio Rodriguez, who was unarmed and walking along a sidewalk on the Mexico side of the border in Nogales, Sonora, when Swartz fired on him through the border wall from the U.S. side. An autopsy shows Rodriguez was shot 10 times with 2 bullets in his head and 8 in his back. Swartz was cleared Monday of second-degree murder while the jury deadlocked on 2 lesser manslaughter charges. Prosecutors said after the trial they're considering whether to bring a new manslaughter trial against Swartz. Following the verdict, scores of protesters marched from the courthouse and blocked busy intersections in downtown Tucson. In Armenia, thousands of people flooded the streets of cities around the country Monday after longtime leader Serge Sarkisian resigned in the face of a popular uprising calling for an end to his rule. The celebrations capped nearly 2 weeks of anti-government protests that Sarkisian's appointment to the newly powerful post of prime minister after he held power as president for the maximum of 2 5-year terms. He came under added pressure to resign after members of Armenia's military in uniform were seen joining recent protests. His resignation came as several opposition leaders were released after their arrests in recent days. And George H.W. Bush has been hospitalized and is in a Houston intensive care unit with sepsis after an infection spread into his bloodstream. A spokesperson for the 93-year-old former president said Bush is responding to treatments and appears to be recovering. Bush's hospitalization came one day after he attended a funeral for his wife, former First Lady Barbara Bush. Saturday's funeral was also attended by other former presidents and first ladies, George W. and Laura Bush, Bill and Hillary Clinton, and Barack and Michelle Obama. First Lady Melania Trump also joined, but President Trump remained at his golf resort in Mar-a-Lago, where the White House says he watched the funeral on television. That weekend, he posted a tweet storm of something like 24 tweets. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. At least 20 people died Sunday when a Saudi-led coalition airstrike hit a wedding party in northern Yemen. Most of the dead were reportedly women and children who were gathered in one of the wedding party tents. The bride was among the dead. Medics and residents said more than 46 others, including 30 children, were also injured. Video footage released by the Yemeni TV station Al Mazira showed a young boy clutching his dead father who was surrounded by rubble. The boy was shouting, "I swear I won't leave him." The attack on the Yemeni wedding party was one of at least 3 airstrikes over the weekend that killed Yemeni civilians. A family of 5 died in an airstrike in the province of Hajjah, and 20 civilians died on Saturday when fighter jets bombed a bus near the city of Taiz.
Meanwhile, Yemen's rebel Houthi movement said senior leader Salah al-Samad had been killed in a Saudi-led coalition airstrike last Thursday. The rebel group warned Samad's killing was a crime that would, quote, not go unanswered. Samad is the most senior Houthi official to have been killed since the Western-backed coalition intervened in Yemen in March 2015. More than 15,000 people have died since the Saudi invasion, while U.S.-backed Saudi-led airstrikes have devastated Yemen's health, water and sanitation systems, sparking a massive cholera outbreak. About 1 million Yemenis are believed to have cholera and pushing millions of Yemenis to the brink of starvation. Earlier this month, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Yemen had become the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Every 10 minutes, a child under 5 dies of preventable causes. And nearly 3 million children under 5 and pregnant or lactating women are actually malnourished. Nearly half of all children aged between 6 months and 5 years old are chronically malnourished and suffer from stunting, which causes development delays and reduced ability to learn throughout their entire lives.
To find out more about the situation in Yemen, we're going now to Boston to speak with Shireen Al-Adeimi, a Yemeni doctoral candidate at Harvard University. Her recent piece for In These Times is headlined, Trump Doesn't Care About Civilian Deaths, Just Look at Yemen. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Shireen. Can you talk about what you understand happened with the Saudi bombing of the Yemeni wedding party that resulted in at least 20 deaths, many of them women and children? Where did this happen?
Thanks so much for having me. And what happened a couple of days ago in Yemen is not unusual. So this happened in a northern province in Hejaz, nowhere near the front lines. This, of course, was a civilian wedding. They struck the men's wedding first, the men's wedding party, and then as rescuers were trying to attend to the injured, they went and, you know, bombed the women's part of the wedding. So this is a double-tap airstrike that is very common in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. 33 were reported to have been killed and several more injured. Tens have been injured. And, you know, 30 children are included in this list of people who are injured. This is a wedding. This is supposed to be the happiest day of people's lives, and instead the bride was killed, the groom injured, and so many more guests ended up killed as well.
And Shireen, for people here who don't understand, since this is a war that Saudi Arabia is waging, how important is the American support, the U.S. support for this war?
So starting with the Obama administration and continuing into through the Trump administration, the Saudis have enjoyed extensive support from the U.S. Army. Right from day one, March 26, 2015, when Saudi Arabia began bombing, the U.S. was right alongside helping them with targeting, with logistics. They help maintain and update their vehicles. And most importantly, the U.S. refuels Saudi jets mid-air, jets that we've sold to them, jets that, you know, bombs that we've sold to them. But we also help operate them. So as they're bombing civilian targets in Yemen, the U.S. Army helps refuel those jets mid-air. So U.S. support of the Saudis is extensive. And, you know, U.S. claims that we are there to help them with precision targeting. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, civilians have borne the brunt of this war. You mentioned 15,000 people have been killed. That's just the number of people who've been killed by airstrikes. We also help them maintain the blockade that's killed 113,000 children in 2016 and 2017 alone due to malnutrition and disease because, you know, water is very limited in the country. Yemen used to import 90% of its food, and that's now become very difficult for people to afford or to find. And so, you know, many people are on the brink, but many people have already been killed and have lost their lives because they just can't find food and water and medicine for, you know, preventable diseases like cholera.
Shireen, can you talk about Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who's overseen the Saudi strikes on Yemen? Can you talk about his recent, what they call, charm offensive throughout the United States, from Washington to Houston to Hollywood? Talk about the significance of this. When President Trump met with him at the White House last month, he held up posters of recent Saudi weapons purchases from the U.S. and said, quote, we make the best equipment in the world.
Saudi Arabia has been a very great friend and a big purchaser of equipment and lots of other things. Some of the things that we're now working on, thanks, and that have been ordered and will shortly be started in construction and delivered. THAAD system, $13 billion. The C-130 airplanes, the Hercules, great plane, $3.8 billion. The Bradley vehicles, that's the tanks, $1.2 billion. And the P-8 Poseidons, $1.4 billion. So we make the best equipment in the world. There's nobody even close. And Saudi Arabia is buying a lot of this equipment.
Shireen Al-Adeimi, the posters that President Trump was holding, almost like a high school presentation, was a map of the United States. As he talked about the weapons, these weapons were sourced to places in the United States, states in the United States. Can you talk about this? Human rights groups warning about the weapons that the massive arms deal that may make the United States complicit in war crimes committed in the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen.
Right. So, of course, Saudi Arabia doesn't manufacture its own weapons. They rely on countries like the U.S. and the U.K. and even Canada to supply them with the weapons needed to wage this incredibly destructive war on a country that really posed no threat to them. So Yemen doesn't even have an air defense system. They've disabled that. And it's a country that's not even able to defend itself. So they've been purchasing these weapons, totaling in the hundreds of billions of dollars, simply for the cause, for the sake of trying to assert control and dominance and trying to win this war that's really unwinnable in Yemen. But, you know, Trump was being transparent about why Mohammed bin Salman was in the U.S., and reportedly Mohammed bin Salman was embarrassed by those posters. But Trump essentially was saying, well, yes, this is the relationship that we have with Saudi Arabia, one that's based on, you know, how much they can pay for our services. I mentioned all the logistical training and updating of aircraft and so on. Those total $129 million per month. So we're making a lot of money. The U.S. is making a lot of money from their relationship with Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups, of course, have warned that these weapons are not being used for any reason other than to target civilians. And countries like Germany and the Netherlands have recently stopped selling weapons to the United Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabians, you know, for this very reason. But here, you know, Prince Charming, he was, you know, we protested his visit here in Boston at MIT. But, you know, places like MIT and Harvard and people like Oprah and the Clintons and, like you said, President Trump, they've all met with him and they've all, you know, he went unchallenged when he was doing interviews here in the United States. And he's not just anybody in the Saudi Arabian royal family. He is the architect of this Yemen war. He is the defense minister and crown prince. This war began under his command. And so this is somebody who's caused, you know, extreme suffering in a country. The UN says that the Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. He has caused this, and we're helping him perpetuate this, yet he was virtually unchallenged while in the United States.
And Shireen, what about, obviously, the United States continues to justify its support under the continuing war on terrorism, and also the attempts to hold back supposed Iranian influence on terrorist groups. What about the situation with ISIS and al-Qaeda and other international terrorist groups within Yemen? Could you talk about that as well? And also the Iran issue.
Right. So Congress has declared that the role of the United States in Yemen, in helping Saudi Arabia in this war in Yemen, is not covered under that, you know, under fighting terrorism. So it's unconstitutional. It's unauthorized by Congress. But like you mentioned, the U.S. is in Yemen on two different fronts. On the one hand, they are trying to target, you know, anybody suspected of being al-Qaeda or ISIS. And that's largely done through drone strikes that really escalated under Obama's administration and have continued through Trump's administration. And then the other front, which is unauthorized by Congress, is this, you know, support, this blanket support of Saudi Arabia in its war on Yemen. Now, you know, they've mentioned Iran as a cause, as a reason to intervene in Yemen. The facts of the matter is that, you know, there's very little evidence that Iran is interfering in any significant way in Yemen. Like I mentioned, there's a land, air, and sea blockade that Saudi Arabia and the United States impose on Yemen. You know, Doctors Without Borders have trouble bringing their personnel, their medicine, their food, their doctors into the country. UN ships have trouble bringing food into the country, but we're somehow led to believe that Iran is able to smuggle missiles or other sorts of weapons to Yemen. So for Yemenis, it's really absurd to think that they're fighting Iran in Yemen. There is no evidence of any Iranian soldiers or any Iranian generals on the ground in Yemen. Of course, the Houthis and Iran have some sort of relationship, but it doesn't. It's very limited, and Iran is not involved in Yemen in the same degree that Saudi Arabia has been claiming. So, you know, Congress has tried to pull the United States out of Yemen, recognizing that it's unauthorized. Bernie Sanders recently introduced a bill in the Senate called SJ Res 54, which was eventually tabled in the Senate. They didn't even vote on it. But that was attempting to extricate the United States out of hostilities in Yemen and by invoking the War Resolutions Act.
And the significance of the Yemen's Houthi movement saying that a senior political figure had died in an attack last Thursday, Salah al-Samad. Who is al-Samad?
So the Houthis, in partnership with the prior president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who maintained significant control in Yemen, they formed a political council that governed, you know, northern areas that they control. Now, the Houthis control a small portion of land, if you look at the map, but about 80% of the population live there. So they still maintain large control over the country compared to what Saudi Arabia controls, which is, you know, land that they control along with ISIS and al-Qaeda and other groups. So, you know, they formed this political council as a way to govern, and Samad was the head of that political council. And so, you know, Saudi Arabia took him out in an airstrike, and there was video posted online yesterday of that attack. It's an assassination, essentially. And I don't know what comes next. You know, here they are. There's no hope, really, for a peace process if leaders like that are going to be executed by Saudi Arabia. So I'm really not sure what comes next.
Shireen Al-Adeimi, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Yemeni doctoral student at Harvard University. She's been speaking out about the role of the United States in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. We'll link to your piece, and in these times, it's headlined, Trump doesn't care about civilian deaths, just look at Yemen. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, there is a power transfer in Cuba. We'll talk about its significance. Stay with us.
En lo que yo te quiero entregar. Para que solo tú le retoces, para romperla luego de amar. Una canción de amor esta noche. Inesperada para mi voz, una canción de amor y de goce, una canción de amor de los dos, una canción chorubiada, una canción chorubiada.
Una Canción, a song by the Cuban legendary musician Silvio Rodriguez, singing live in Central Park's summer stage last year. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Cuba, where for the first time since its socialist revolution toppled dictator Fulgencio Batista in 1959, a president who does not have the last name Castro has taken power. Miguel Díaz-Canel was sworn in as president last Thursday. He succeeds Raúl Castro, who served two consecutive five-year terms in office. Castro is now 86 years old, and he will remain the head of the Cuban Communist Party. Fidel Castro handed over power to his brother Raúl in 2008 while his health deteriorated, and Fidel Castro died in 2016. Thursday's session was held on the 57th anniversary of Cuba's 1961 defeat of a CIA-backed Cuban exile invasion known as the Bay of Pigs. Díaz-Canel began his term with a promise to defend the socialist revolution of Cuba.
I accept the responsibility for which I have been elected with the conviction that all Cuban revolutionaries, from the position we occupy, from the work we do, from every job and trench of the socialist motherland, will be faithful to the exemplary legacy, will be faithful to the exemplary legacy of the commander-in-chief Fidel Castro Ruz, historic leader of our revolution, and also faithful to the example, the courage, and the teachings of Army General Raúl Castro Ruz, current leader of the revolutionary process.
On Saturday, the newly sworn-in Cuban president received his first official visit by a foreign leader, the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro.
Cuba and Venezuela are in the best condition to unite forces. We've done it before with great results. Every time we took a step forward, the enemies of our motherland said, you can't. And we always showed that, yes, we can.
For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Peter Kornbluh, who directs the Cuba Documentation Project and National Security Archive at George Washington University. He has a new cover story for Politico on reporter Lisa Howard's extensive back-channel diplomacy with Cuba. It's headlined, My Dearest Fidel, an ABC journalist secret liaison with Fidel Castro. Kornbluh is also co-author of the book Back-Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Peter, welcome back to Democracy Now! First of all, talk about the significance of what has just taken place, the stepping down of Raul Castro as president and who has replaced him.
Well, in many ways, it's a historic moment because there aren't going to be either Fidel or Raul Castro prominently being the face of the Cuban Revolution any longer. And this is, in a sense, the first step towards the post-Castro era. But the truth of the matter is, and even though the conventional wisdom in the mainstream media is that the Castro era has ended, Raul Castro is stepping back, but he's really not stepping down from power. As Juan pointed out, he remains head of the Cuban Communist Party. He also remains the highest official in the Cuban military, both very, very powerful positions. Plus, his son, Alejandro Castro, is one of the highest intelligence officials in Cuba and is certainly an important figure to be reckoned with there. You know, and it's important that Raul Castro is still head of the is still Secretary General of the Cuban Communist Party because he really was not able to complete his agenda. His disciple, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who readily admits to being his disciple, has to continue to push Cuba forward. And he can only do that since he has no legitimacy of his own as a historico, as a historic figure in the Cuban Revolution, he can only do that with the support of Raul Castro. So it is important that Raul is kind of staying in the game, if you will.
And Peter, could you set for us who is Miguel Díaz-Canel? Because the reality is that over the decades, there have been many supposed successors that emerged in the Cuban government to the Castro brothers, but they all sort of like fell by the wayside in different periods of time. And could you talk about, give a thumbnail sketch of who Miguel Díaz is?
Well, I should say that those other potential successors were purged along the way for various issues and problems that arose when it was clear that neither Fidel nor Raul were ready to kind of anoint a next generation of leadership. And Miguel Díaz-Canel is the next generation of leadership. He has risen steadily, methodically through the Cuban Communist Party. He was electrical engineer by training, but he went into party politics. He became the provincial leader of Santa Clara during the special period after the collapse of the Soviet Union and kind of gained a reputation of being accessible and kind of an everyman. He rode his bike to meetings. People were able to talk to him. He encouraged debate. So he was an accessible person. He was kind of picked for the success of that. To be Minister of Education in 2009 and then anointed first vice president in 2013, which meant that he was Raul's kind of designated successor. And that's where we've arrived today. Cuba faces a lot of significant challenges. The fact that Nicolas Maduro was there is obviously fraternal support from one of the key countries that Cuba still is very allied to in Latin America. But the truth is that Venezuela is in the midst of its own economic crisis and unable to truly support the Cuban economy now. And the Cuban economy is in a significant crisis. And this is what Miguel Díaz-Canel and the next generation of Cuban leadership is going to have to address.
On Wednesday, President Trump told reporters, we love Cuba, we're going to take care of Cuba. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert was later asked to clarify Trump's comment.
Today, Donald Trump said, we love Cuba, we're going to take care of Cuba, we're going to take care of it. Does that mean that the U.S. believes that it can actually work with the new president in trying to...
Well, as you know, we maintain diplomatic relations with the Cuban government, so that that continues, but we can certainly be disappointed with the election that we don't see to be free as fair. We also recognize that there are strong people-to-people ties between Cuban Americans and some Cuban families who still live back home, and also there are some businesses that take part in the Cuban economy as well.
So this doesn't mean that the Trump administration is going to roll back any kind of...
I'm not aware of any changes on our policy. I think the president was just recognizing some of the work and people-to-people ties that we have.
So that's State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert. Peter Kornbluh, if you can talk about the status of U.S.-Cuba relations, you know, anything with Obama's name on it, President Trump wants to push back. He said he was closing he was ending the thaw of relations with Cuba. What actually has happened?
Well, let me just say two things. One is that the State Department's statement, which you just broadcast, is really should be considered somewhat moderate, given Trump's rather hostile rhetoric over the last few months. And Trump saying, you know, we're taking care of Cuba, we're going to take care of Cuba, is kind of ironic because he's saying it on the anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which the Cubans chose deliberately and symbolically for this transfer of power, the day that one of the small countries of Latin America defeated the colossus of the North in April of 1961. And Cuba, under President Kennedy. And, of course, Cuba has proven since that time that it can take care of itself and that it doesn't need the United States to take care of it. And this transition of leadership in Cuba doesn't change that in any way. Cuba will continue to take care of itself. I mean, it should be clear, you know, Donald Trump has completely changed 100% the civil tone of relations that Barack Obama set. But he hasn't actually fully changed or even significantly, in my opinion, changed the actual policy. We still have diplomatic relations. There are a number of issues with the embassy being kind of reduced in staff that are very significant for our kind of daily interaction and for Cubans to be able to come to the United States. They can no longer get visas in Havana itself. And Trump has scared U.S. travelers away from going to Cuba with travel alerts about the so-called sonic attacks in Cuba and kind of tweaking and restricting the kind of way we go, the licenses that we need, the categories that we travel under. And this has actually had an amazing impact on travel. I mean, American citizens are traveling less to Cuba, this is having a significant impact on the private sector in Cuba, which had gotten all geared up for the tourist sector. And it is an important issue. So even though the policy hasn't really changed, even just the hostile rhetoric and the tweaking has had an impact on U.S.-Cuban relations.
Peter, can we switch for a little bit? Can you talk about your new cover story for Politico, My Dearest Fidel, an ABC journalist secret liaison with Fidel Castro, this amazing story of this former anchor on ABC News, Lisa Howard, and her relationship to Castro?
Well, you know, this is an important historical topic because in this day and age, we're still looking for what Lisa Howard back in 1963 called an honorable rapprochement with Cuba. It appeared that Barack Obama had achieved this, and now President Donald Trump is sabotaging that. But Barack Obama's kind of back-channel efforts to find common ground and a modus vivendi with the Cuban Revolution really in some ways starts more than 50 years before with this pioneering ABC News journalist named Lisa Howard. Nobody remembers her today, but she was the first female correspondent for a full-time correspondent for ABC News, and she was the first woman to have her own serious news show. It was called Lisa Howard and News with a Woman's Touch, sponsored by Purex. And it was geared, as ABC put it, for women by a woman. But she was a really tenacious reporter. She set her sights on getting an interview with Fidel Castro, and she finally scored one in the spring of 1963. And, you know, this was very important. In that day and age, Fidel was just dismissed as the devil incarnate, a communist in the Caribbean. She went down there and actually talked to him and put him on the air and tried to introduce him and his issues to the American public. And, of course, she asked about what he wanted with U.S.-Cuban relations. And he said, we think we can have better relations with President Kennedy. We think a rapprochement is possible. And from that point on, she, through kind of secretly, pressed the issue with U.S. officials, first in the Kennedy administration, then in the Johnson administration, of improving ties. And she became Castro's and Kennedy's and Johnson's interlocutor between each other. She actually established a channel of direct communication from Castro's office to the Oval Office. And this is a history that's really not very known. William Leo Grant and I wrote about it a bit in our book, Back Channel to Cuba. And now I've written the fuller story based on her personal papers in Politico magazine. It's quite a story, and it has, I think, really great relevance to today. We are still looking for what she called that honorable rapprochement.
Peter, I want to turn to an excerpt of Lisa Howard's 1963 interview with Fidel Castro, which aired on ABC News.
Dr. Castro, do you feel there is any basis for a return to normal relations with the United States and Cuba, with you as Prime Minister, and do you desire such a rapprochement?
I think it is possible if the United States government wish, and in that case, we would be agreed to speak and to find the basis.
That was Lisa Howard interviewing Fidel Castro in 1963. Just amazing. Before that, she'd interviewed Khrushchev. She was a soap star in the 50s, right? She was The Edge of Night, As the World Turns, Guiding Light for CBS television. Put it all down, said, I care more about what's going on in the world. Goes on to interview Che Guevara as well, but ultimately would commit suicide. Is that right?
Yes, she died on Independence Day of 1965 from an overdose of barbiturates in the Hamptons. In some ways, she flamed out. But she had some personal setbacks. She'd had a miscarriage. She'd been fired from ABC News for kind of openly opposing Robert Kennedy's run for the Senate from New York because he was a carpetbagger. And she and the other liberal Democrats in New York thought that this was just, you know, crazy that he should come into their state and decide he could represent them. And she did that somewhat openly. And as a TV news anchor, ABC tried to restrain her from being so overtly political. And when she wouldn't cooperate, they actually terminated her appearance on the
show. And you only found out about her personal, intimate relationship with Fidel Castro because of the documents that have since come forward. She nor he ever talked about them, the relationship.
There's in the declassified U.S. documents, you see this tension because U.S. officials don't want to really use her as an interlocutor because they think she's a prominent news personality. She was one of the most famous news personalities in the United States of America in the early 60s. We've all forgotten this. And they were worried that she would go on TV one day and talk about this back channel diplomacy that was going on and break the story and embarrass them. And so they were very reticent to deal with her, but she tenaciously pushed it. She repeatedly told them that she would be discreet, and she was. She took the secret of this relationship with Castro, the interaction, the secret diplomacy to her grave. Castro himself also never really spoke about it publicly. But she, luckily for us, did record her interactions with him and her conversations in personal notes that I was able to obtain some years ago from her widower, Walter Lowendahl. And we have this important history, and it's just one of those great examples of two things. One, the historical foundations of the need to normalize relations with Cuba and the fact that it's been tried before and that it's a great story. And two, she really was a citizen diplomat, if you will. She self-appointed herself as a secret emissary between Cuba and the United States. And if Donald Trump and the Trump administration is not going to have civil relations with the new government of Cuba, then it's really up to us Americans to be that type of civil diplomat and conduct our own diplomacy.
Peter Kornbluh, we want to thank you for being with us. Directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. We'll link to your piece about Lisa Howard and Politico, My Dearest Fidel, an ABC journalist secret liaison with Fidel Castro. Peter Kornbluh is author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. When we come back, we go to Memphis, Tennessee. A well-known reporter there is arrested by police and handed over to ICE. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the story of a prominent Latino journalist in Memphis, detained by immigration officials after he was arrested while covering a protest against immigration detention outside a county jail. Manuel Duran, who was born in El Salvador, is a well-known reporter on Spanish radio stations in Memphis. He also runs the online site Memphis Noticias. This is Duran beginning his coverage of the protest on April 3rd.
Buenas tardes, amigos de Memphis Noticias. En estos momentos iniciamos la participación con todos ustedes.
This protest is going to be held in front of 201 Poplar. And let me tell you what is the purpose of this demonstration. As you can see, everything is getting ready here. This protest is happening because of different reasons. One of them is that, according to the demonstrators and the organizations participating in this march, the reason for this protest is that due process is not being respected.
So that's Manuel Duran reporting on Facebook Live. About 15 minutes later, as he and other journalists covered demonstrators crossing a street bound together in chains, police stepped in to arrest an activist. Several officers then turned to Duran himself and ordered him to get out of the street. This is footage from Duran's phone.
Get out of the street. Where are you going? I don't care. Get on the sidewalk. Get on the sidewalk. Get him out.
That's one officer saying, quote, get him, guys, before Duran's phone falls to the ground. This confrontation between police and activists escalates with two women trying to protect Duran, shouting, he's a reporter. This is footage from another camera.
Duran was arrested and held in Shelby County Jail. On April 5th, the state dropped criminal charges against him, but he was then detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. He was quickly transferred to the La Salle Detention Center, 6 hours from Memphis in Jenna, Louisiana. Local immigrant groups are calling for his release.
Well, for more, we're joined by three guests in Memphis, Tennessee. Melissa Valdez is with us, Manuel Duran's longtime partner, Mauricio Calvo, executive director of Latino Memphis and Immigrants Rights Groups, and Christy Graunke, senior attorney with the Southern Poverty Law Center, joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina, one of Manuel Duran's lawyers. Let's begin with Christy Graunke, his lawyer. What's happened right now? Where is he? On what grounds did they arrest him and then hand him over to ICE?
Well, he's now in La Salle Detention Facility in Jena, Louisiana. And the grounds he was arrested, he was alleged to be blocking a roadway in Memphis and to be engaging in disorderly conduct. And, of course, those charges were dropped. But, unfortunately, he was turned over almost immediately in very rapid fashion to ICE and taken immediately to La Salle Detention Center in Jena, Louisiana, where he is right now.
And Mauricio Calvo, could you talk about his importance in Memphis to the Latino community there in Memphis and what his role has been over the years?
Absolutely. I mean, we believe every person is important. Manuel is not the first one, the only one, or the last one who will be suffering of the consequences of the Trump deportation machine. But particularly Manuel, he played a very important role. He was a journalist for a community that often doesn't have somebody who sounds like them or looks like them or talks like them on the media. So Manuel played a very important role reporting everything from government issues to cultural issues. He was really and truly the voice of the Latino community in Memphis. Mm.
Melissa Valdez, I know this is extremely hard for you as your partner is now in jail in Gina, Louisiana. Can you talk about Manuel's life and also his passion of journalism in Memphis and covering particularly these kinds of protests?
Yes, he was very passionate about his work. He's been doing journalism for a very long time. Almost since he was a kid back in El Salvador, and then he brought it all the way to the U.S. when he immigrated here. So he was very passionate. He would get up in the morning and go out and try to speak. People would reach out to him and say, okay, look, this happened to me. I need you. I need you to try to investigate, ask the police, why is this happening? So he would go out and speak to the families and then bring the news to everybody else. He has a very large, audience on social media and also on a personal level.
Have you seen him in jail?
I have, yes.
And what are the conditions there?
Well, he looks, to be honest with you, he looks miserable. He's never been in locked up in like this for this amount of time, so... he's just trying to stay strong. I guess he knows me and he wants me to stay strong. So he's trying to fake it. Sometimes he fails. And I can see him take a breath and try to calm down while he's inside. And actually, last time I saw him, it was on Monday morning. And he almost begged me not to leave. I mean, he's like, I know you need to take a rest, but when are you coming back? And I was like, I'll be back soon. Don't worry about it.
And Christy Gronke, could you talk a little bit about Manuel's legal status in terms of immigration? When did he come to the country? Was he originally here legally and then fell into a status that was not legal?
So he came to the country in 2006, and shortly after arriving was presented with papers by immigration authorities alleging that he was not in the country lawfully. He was then subsequently removed, what we call in absentia, which means that there was an immigration hearing held. He did not attend. He did not get proper notice of that hearing. And so that in the absence of him actually being able to present arguments as to why he might be entitled to immigration relief, he was summarily ordered deported. And that order has been on the books since 2007. So what we're trying to do right now is reopen that case. And, you know, Manuel's story is incredibly important on an individual level, but it also highlights some serious problems with due process in our immigration system. And an extraordinarily high percentage of immigration orders are these in absentia orders, which are entered summarily. If an immigrant fails to show up at simply one hearing to present their arguments, they can be ordered removed in absentia, and that's what happened to him. So we're trying to reopen that and hopefully have an opportunity to present arguments that he faces danger were he to be removed to El Salvador. As a journalist, he would face great danger, particularly practicing the type of journalism that he practices.
And your petition lays out certain First Amendment protections for him as well because of his journalism here?
That's right. So we're proceeding on two legal tracks. One is trying to reopen his immigration case and get him the fair hearing that he never got in front of an immigration judge and an opportunity, a chance to present his arguments as to why he's entitled to immigration relief. The other petition that we filed is with a federal court in the Western District of Louisiana, which is the area that Gina, the LaSalle detention facility, is located. And we're contending that his continued detention violates the First Amendment and the Fourth, Fifth, and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. because his arrest was clearly without probable cause and without a warrant, and it was also retaliatory. This is a man who was very prominent in the press, in the local community, speaking out against the Memphis Police Department and ICE, and particularly the collaboration between the two. So it's notable that he was the only journalist arrested at that protest. He was arrested when he was trying to comply with police orders. Arrested on false charges. Those charges were dropped, and then he's rapidly turned over to ICE and taken to Louisiana, away from his community and away from the lawyers that he had at that point, who were in Memphis. So that's very those are very striking facts, and we're arguing that his detention is unlawful and unconstitutional on those grounds.
I want to read from a statement that Manuel Duran released last week from ICE detention. He writes, "Through this experience, I've learned firsthand details about the treatment our immigrants receive before they're deported, how they keep the lights on day and night and you have to sleep with a towel over your eyes, how they make you lie in bed for 45 minutes in what seems to be at random after roll calling, and you cannot use the phone or the bathroom during that time, how they would not let you know your attorney is on the phone, how you get paid dimes for work and you're on your own if you have no one outside adding funds to your commissary, how the visitation hours and your recreation hours happen at the same time, so you have to choose between seeing your family and getting some air, how the phones in the visitation room do not work, and you have to scream through the soundproof windows." And then I want to read ICE's statement, ICE officials issuing this statement about Manuel Duran's case, saying, "Mr. Duran Ortega was ordered removed from the United States by a federal immigration judge in January 2007 after failing to appear for a scheduled court date. He's been an immigration fugitive since that time. Mr. Duran Ortega is currently in ICE custody pending removal." He's been a fugitive since that time. Manuel, I wanted to ask Mauricio Calvo about his relationship with the public officials, the police, in the community. He is a well-known reporter in Memphis, hardly a fugitive, hardly hidden away.
I think, obviously, that's the wrong adjective to call somebody a fugitive. I mean, one thing that people often make mistakes is they need to understand that immigration law is not criminal law. I mean, if Manuel had been a fugitive, he had been at the office of many officials, and he had been arrested before. I mean, this is absolutely false. Obviously, this was politically motivated. As soon as immigration saw the opportunity to go after him, they are going after him, and they want to make a case. And we're going to make a case that we're not going to let ICE or anybody else just walk over our constitutional rights of people. And that's what we partnered with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and we are really working to make sure that every American and every aspiring American rights are protected by the same rules.
And Melissa, I wanted to ask you, in your private discussions and talks with Manuel, did you ever discuss the issue of the more public he was, given the fact that he had a deportation order, that he might be picked up? And because obviously he felt that it was more important to report the news than to worry about his personal safety.
Yeah, I mean, being an immigrant here in the U.S., that's something you think about any given day. So we knew it was a risk. He took it. He loved his work more. I mean, it's definitely on our minds at all times that the deportation is a possibility, and it's not just him, it's everybody I know a lot of people who are in the same situation, so it was on our mind.
Mauricio, what is the relationship between the Latino immigrant community in Memphis and the police?
For the most part, Memphis is a very welcoming community, and the police, even though this was clearly a mistake, for the most part, they have tried to make ties with the community. In fact, Manuel has been in conversations with the police director and with other officials on how to stretch those relationships. I mean, my concern here is, locals, municipalities, and states cannot fix the immigration problem by themselves, but they can certainly make it worse. And this is a perfect example of how they can make it worse. It was an unfortunate chain of events, and everything starts from a state law that mandates that the sheriff will hold people for eyes. And again, this is one of those issues that makes no sense. This jurisdiction, crossing over jurisdictions, why is a local sheriff having to enforce immigration law? For some viewers or for some listeners may say, well, because that's the law. And absolutely it's not. I mean, you would not think that a police officer will pull you over and ask you a question about your tax return, because the IRS law is enforced by the IRS, not by your local police department. Why? Because local police departments need and want to have a strong relationship with all their citizens. First, because they have the duty to protect them, but also because if they ever become victims, they want to have the freedom and the certainty that they can report a crime without fear of deportation or a relationship with ICE. So, for the most part, Memphis has been a very welcoming community. Again, this is an example of something that slipped through the cracks and that we all are going to have to be working to rebuild that trust between law enforcement and the local community.
We want to thank you all for being with us. Mauricio Calvo, Executive Director of Latino Memphis, Melissa Valdez, Manuel Duran's partner, and Christy Graunke, lawyer representing Manuel Duran, senior attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Accepting applications for a paid year-long social media fellowship. Also, I'll be speaking today in Teaneck, New Jersey at noon at the Puffin Cultural Forum. And Juan will be speaking Friday night at Columbia University. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.